Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today, we're going to be talking about diversity in science. What does that mean, and how do we go about enhancing diversity if we assume that diversity is good, not just for science, but for almost any activity that humans do? By the way, my name's Keith Pannell. We're going to talk today to Dr. Irene Avila. She's from the Office of the Director of the National Institutes of Health, and Irene has got specific responsibilities for overviewing and viewing the various activities of the National Institutes of Health to see how different subsections are dealing with the need for diversity of opinion, diversity of working force, and what it is that we can do, or NIH can do, to enhance that diversity. So that seems like a lot of things that you're supposed to do. So welcome to Science Studio, Irene.
Thank you.
Before we get into your role with the director's office at NIH, let's go back. How did you get into a career in science? What were the driving forces when you were a little girl, if you had any?
Wildlife. Just nature. My father was really into plants and trees. So just, you know, understanding about the different species and just the diversity of flowers and plants. And then, you know, being from California, the Bay Area, the diversity of the marine life, you know. So I really enjoyed whales and dolphins and seals and sea lions. So, you know, I always was eager to go to SeaWorld or to the aquarium. It was just so intriguing that these animals spend most of their lives in the water, but, you know, are on land sometimes. So it's like, why is that? You know, how do they survive? And just trying to understand those differences between marine mammals and humans.
Did it make you want to swim? I mean, just from day one, were you an interested swimmer? Or
so that's the intriguing question, because I don't know how to swim. But I love being out in the boat, and I love, you know, getting the binoculars out and trying to see, do I see a blowhole out there? Is there a whale? You know, are we approaching?
But the boat was the preference.
The boat was a preference.
Did you ever see the great blue whales?
I have still to this day not seen it in the wild.
Because that's one of the most wonderful memories I have of taking some of my children down to Guerrero Negro in Baja in Mexico, where they come down. And they're the gray whales.
The gray whales.
Not the blue whales, the gray whales. And then they reproduce down there in the February, January. Magic to go down there. Because first of all, it's not a big tourist trap. You know, they're just little boats, pongas, I think they're called.
Pongas,
and you go out there in those, just holds three or four people, and the whales come up and they go underneath. It's magic.
I went to UC Santa Cruz for my undergrad, and I had an opportunity through the Minority International Research Training Program. You know, it was only supposed to be for a handful of months for me to go down there and do some work with the marine mammals and the researchers there, but I ended up spending 18 months.
Okay, lovely.
You know, we'd go out into the Sea of Cortez, and we'd just, you know, what was out there when we'd go? You know, we saw whale sharks, hammerhead sharks.
It's a great area. Your interest as a young child developed into going to school and studying. How did that progress?
What was intriguing is they had this, what was called psychobiology program. So it was a combination of psychology because of the behavior aspects, but under the biological basis of behavior. So fortunately, a lot of the psychology classes were really geared towards some circadian rhythms and cognition. But then you had to take all these biology classes with physiology, bioenergetics. So it's like, well, how do these two meet? You know, neuroscience class was like one thing, but it didn't bridge that behavior and the biological basis of it. So when I was in Mexico, there was a professor from the University of Arizona. Her name was Terry Marcaw, and she knew Eddie. And she's like, I think you and Eddie would be a great match. And so she connected me with Eddie Castaneda,
who's a faculty member here at UT El Paso now.
Right. And he recruited me to Arizona State to study the behavioral basis of Parkinson's disease. So my advisor at UC Santa Cruz said, you know, it's great that you like marine mammals and you want to study them, but, you know, biomedical research is really where the exciting research is happening in neuroscience and understanding the brain and behavior.
Okay. So interesting. So they persuaded you to skip out of looking at animals and look at humans and different issues. Let's talk a little bit about Parkinson's, because people know the word, but what is Parkinson's disease?
So it's a neurological disorder. There are specific brain nuclei. It's called the basal ganglia circuitry. And the basal ganglia circuitry has different pathways. So there's the motor movement pathway. It's also involved with motivation. So how it's also other diseases is like drug abuse, addiction, and then also with some memory. Because, you know, with motor movement, you have some memory of how you do your movements, as well as addiction. There's a memory of where you had your hit, and, you know, so they all kind of interconnect with each other.
That's interesting, because when you wave to someone, you don't actually think that you're remembering how you're supposed to wave. But, of course, your body, some muscle memory or something like that.
Yeah.
But you don't think of memory and Parkinson's together. At least I don't.
No, you don't think of them together, because the main thing that gets affected is your motor movements. But unfortunately, the nuclei, substantia nigra pars compacta, is where all the dopamine cells that get destroyed in Parkinson's disease are found. And it's a really small region in your brain. And you can't detect that loss of those cells until more than 70% of them have died. And then that's kind of when those symptoms start to appear. So it's kind of pretty late in the disease that you get diagnosed you have Parkinson's.
Uh-huh. And so that's one of the areas, I think, probably of major research, is to find a way to analyze that little section of the brain. What's it called?
Substantia nigra pars compacta.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. Anyway, so you studied this for a few years as a graduate student.
Yes.
And where did you do the graduate studies? Just in Arizona, or?
So I did my master's with Eddie at ASU, Arizona State University, and then I won an award through SOCNA, Society for Advancement of Chicanos and Native Americans in Science. It was like a neuroscience kind of travel fellowship, and with it, I got an opportunity to do a summer internship at the National Institutes of Health, and I got to work with Tom Chase, who's was very popular in the field of coming up with new pharmacological treatments to help Parkinson's patients, and he was very much bench to bedside. So there was a part of the lab that worked with rodents, a part of the lab that worked with non-human primates, and then it went to the patient. So it was just like really exciting to go to NIH for a summer, work with this man, this, you know, doctor who works with patients that you knew your research was going to have an impact on.
That's translational research in a sense, right? That is exciting, but it also brings a big responsibility too. Right. I mean, it's one thing to go into a laboratory and do experiments and make sure they're reproducible, but you can't do that with patients. I mean, they can't be subject like guinea pigs that, oh, well, if it didn't work this time, we'll just change the protocol and do it a different way.
Which is why we had the big rodent lab. And then once, you know, after you had your big sample size of rodents to show that there was an important result, then it would go to the non-human primates. You know, that limits your subject matter there too, because they only would have a couple of subjects to use. And then, you know, once they got positive results there that were, you know, repeatable, then you could experimentally try in clinical trials.
If you summarize what results you got out of your PhD work, what was the most exciting and unexpected result that came out of your work?
So the exciting thing that was to show that they had kind of identified this beta frequency range in Parkinson's patients, and it was kind of like this resting beta showing.
I don't know what that means.
So you have different frequencies in your brain. You know, you have your sleep gamma. You talk about gamma frequency when you're in like REM sleep.
The frequency of what?
The neural activity in your brain.
Okay.
So when you look at a population in a certain region of the brain, it emits a certain frequency.
Okay.
And
I didn't know this.
So there's sleep waves, you know, there's gamma waves, and when you're in REM sleep, and then it changes when you're not in REM. So that was already well recognized, those frequencies during sleep. But it was just, we're just hitting, like, identifying those frequencies in Parkinson's patients and how the activity becomes abnormal. Certain frequencies become abnormal with Parkinson's disease.
Well, now, I mean, is that a potential diagnosis for earlier on, that you see changes in those frequencies? I mean, if you could have somebody 30 years old and then go and regularly and do this analysis and see changes over time, that might be a diagnostic tool?
Well, it would be hard to do it in humans because the nuclei are deep in the middle of your brain.
Oh.
So you'd have to insert
a
probe.
Oh, you have to drill a hole. Okay, forget it.
So with late stages of Parkinson's disease where the gold standard L-DOPA treatment doesn't work. They usually try to find other ways, and brain stimulation is one way of doing it. And they insert it into another nuclei that's kind of like the relay station, and where the input and the output kind of, you know, the information flow.
Okay.
It's like the relay station. So they kind of, with electrical stimulation, kind of try to change that signal between those cells, and it gives you a different output, and it kind of balances back those frequencies.
That electrical stimulation, I just heard, probably on the BBC, it's coming back a little bit. It went through a disfavorable period of time. People thought it was just medieval, but now it's sort of coming back, that I guess because we're much more capable of putting electrodes in very specific locations rather than blasting away and
hoping. The technology's gotten better,
right?
And they're using it for other diseases and disorders like depression and pain.
So why did you not carry on in that area as a career? You obviously now got it into a whole different but interesting area.
Yeah.
We'll come on to that soon. But what made you change directions?
It didn't feel right, that I just felt like I was going to keep encountering more barriers with people not believing in me and kind of trying to hold me back or trying to pigeonhole me into one aspect of being more of a technician instead of a scientist who's kind of thinking of ideas. And
that's a very sad sort of a response, in the sense that the implication is that you weren't necessarily getting the correct mentoring and encouragement at some stage during this period of time.
Yes, I was getting misguided, and I was kind of floundering a little, reaching out to different people who had somewhat mentored me through the years, going back to Eddie, you know, just trying to go back to my heart and what really was I really passionate about, and trying to identify that. If I was really passionate about going into academia, then I would have to push forward and, you know, overcome more obstacles to get there.
That's a tough business going into that, and it's even tougher staying.
So did I want to do something I knew I was passionate about, but it was going to be hard and difficult? Or was there something else that I could do with my PhD that would still satisfy me but not impose so many barriers?
I think we'll just stop at that moment and take a short break. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm talking here with Dr. Irene Avila from the Director's Office of the NIH, where she has responsibility on enhancing diversity in the biomedical research. And we'll explain what that means when we come back. We'll be back. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Irene Avila from the Director's Office of the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. And as I was saying earlier, Irene, or you told me, your role up there is to sort of take a big picture of the function of the National Institutes of Health with a particular goal of enhancing diversity. Let's talk about that a little bit. What is termed diversity up in NIH land?
So back in 2012, Donna Ginther published a report about funding disparities, specifically for African-American blacks, how there was a huge gap between that population of scientists versus white Caucasian scientists. And the NIH director has an advisory committee to the director, and he had a special working group kind of come together and brainstorm ideas and like, how do we address this? And from that group, they came up with 12 recommendations. One of them was to establish this office I'm in and hire a chief officer for scientific workforce diversity. Dr. Hannah Valentine is the inaugural chief officer, and her goal is to implement those additional 11 recommendations. So right now, it's been about 3 years that she's been in office, and she co-chairs that working group. And we're now putting a report together addressing where are we at with those other recommendations, and looking today where we are with all of our programming at NIH, what are some additional recommendations that we need to address going forward?
I mean, can you relate to say, look, I don't know how many institutes there are in the National Institutes of Health. There's a lot of them.
There's 27 institutes and centers.
Oh, thank you very much. And I'm sure since you work with the director's office, that's an exactly correct number. But can you tell me, tell the audience, is there much of a difference in the success of augmenting and enhancing diversity from one institute to another? Are there some institutes where it's, you know, not such a big of a problem as it is, say, in others?
I think it's like any university institution. You have good mentors and you have bad mentors. The way the tenure process is at NIH, you're like a tenure track for about, you know, 5 to 10 years, and then you become tenured and you're a senior investigator, and then you're a senior investigator until you retire.
But my question was more to the point of, like, there's the National Institutes of NIGMS, General Medical Science, and there's the National Institutes of Mental Health or something like that. Do you see differences within those? So if I can compare those two institutes and you say, well, NIGMS is doing a much better job at augmenting and enhancing diversity.
Well, from experience, I did my graduate work at Neurological Disorders and Stroke and my postdoc at the Institute on Aging. So they were very different. NINDS has a bigger budget than NIA. So there was, you know, I see those budget restrictions. The way the PIs are evaluated, because they get evaluated every 4 years from an outside committee, I saw differences in that whole process as well. So each IC is very independent and does their evaluations, and you know, their budget is very different.
But do one institute compared to another do a better job at being able to enhance diversity?
There are some that are very, very vocal about it, like the Dental and Cranial Research Institute. They have a very strong understanding of why diversity is important, and they've been doing things internally. They get it.
And so do you,
Neurological Disorders and Stroke, they're trying to develop new things as well to have programming to enhance diversity. You can see that there are individual institutes that are doing it, and we get excited and they become partners with us, like the Cancer Institute and NIGMS, NINDS.
Okay, so there are variations.
Yes.
But, I mean, when you want change, when you want to sort of enhance some aspect of your functioning, okay, you can institutionalize it, or you can hire someone that really has got a passion. And so do you think from your experience up there that where that one institute, the Cranial Institute, is particularly good at seeing this and getting it, as you pointed out, is that because there's a particular person or persons there that are driving this, or somehow it's built into the administration of that particular institute?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't thought about it that way. Don't have a quick answer for that.
No, but I mean, it's just one of those things that is worth pursuing, because you can institutionalize change, but sometimes that doesn't work. Institutions are really messy. But individuals with responsibility can accomplish an awful lot. And I just wonder if it's something that the NIH is wondering about. You know, does each institute, for example, have someone like yourself that's responsible for augmenting and enhancing diversity within the institute?
Yes.
So you have counterparts.
Well, not like our office, but some like offices that and staff who this is, you know, one big part of their job is diversity, training in diversity.
Dr. Avila, tell us, why is diversity important?
There are multiple levels and different ways you can think about it. One is fairness. You look at the demographics of the U.S. and you see that what are considered minority groups are starting to slowly become the majority, but they're not well represented in science and in academic positions. Another is you think about when you approach questions, teams that are diverse usually come up with more innovative ideas to
have
solve a problem.
Have people done that experiment? Have they actually put together, I'll call it a committee, a group of people, all guys like me, you know, white Anglo-Saxon, Protestant or non-Protestant, makes no difference, and then a diverse group, and then a group full of only African-Americans or only Hispanics. Has that been documented, that the mixed group usually is more creative?
There's this one study out there, and it's about guessing the weight of a cow.
Guessing the weight of a cow.
Yeah. Okay. So if you have the same,
white Anglo-Saxon males, guys have never pushed a cow around. I know that.
Or one individual trying to guess the weight of a cow versus a diverse group. You know, when you put the numbers of the diverse group together, their average is closer to what the cow's weight is.
That's compared to one observer outside, though, right?
Yeah.
But if you had that same group, but it was all white Anglo-Saxon females, white Anglo-Saxon males, African-American males, they would also come up with a better answer because there's more of them.
Right.
So that's not really a fair comparison. I want to know a group of homogeneous group versus a heterogeneous group. You know, is there any data out there to show that more creative, more accurate results can be forthcoming?
I think one thing when it comes in relation to science is looking at the diversity of the co-authors and how impactful that research is by citations, how many times it's been cited. And so the more diverse the co-authors are, and it's not just race, ethnicity, but it's like from different institutions, collaborations versus yes. single authors or a couple of authors from the same institution, the team gets cited more.
Yeah, that's very interesting. One could argue, of course, that once you increase more institutions, then people within the institutions learn about the work. And so there's more institutions knowing about the work, and therefore there's going to be slightly more citations, possibly, right? It's a tough area to get.
Yeah.
It's human behavior, again, which is, you know, I like test tubes and instrumentation, and I don't have to deal with the variations of personality very much. But what you're talking about really is to do with the variations of social groups.
Yes. And for NIH, you know, we want to improve the health of the human, and we have very complex problems. Having yeah. diverse teams to address these problems and come with new innovative ways will help us reach those goals. And the clinical-wise, too, by diversifying the clinical workforce, everyday people will feel comfortable going to the doctors and talking about, you know, their symptoms if they see people like them.
I can see that. I would imagine if I was a female, I'd prefer to go to OBGYN, it was at least a female, as opposed to a male. Well, okay, Irene, so I see what it is that you're sort of up against, in a sense. How will you know if your program is having an impact? As you know, I run the Minority Access to Research Careers Program, now called Maximizing Access to Research Careers Program. It's an NIH to get young students onto PhD pathway and then academic posts. And I'm always being asked to evaluate, well, what are my outcomes? You know, how successful have I been? And, you know, being a scientist, I tend to think numbers is quite sufficient. But then they say, oh, well, it must be some other measurement devices. Let me throw it to you. How will you know at NIH? How do you evaluate yourself as how successful your interventions or your program is going to be?
Yeah, so we're building our team of social psychologists who have strong evaluation and intervention design. So we've been running an implicit bias education at NIH that our social psychologist team have been running, and they collect data. So they've been collecting like pre and post data. So before the actual presentation is given, they ask the participants, please take this test. And then they compare it to the test they take after they receive the presentation to look at how, if you bring an awareness to your implicit biases, how does that change your way of thinking? So they're using what Brian Nozak and his team created called the implicit attitude test. It's a reaction time test. So it words pop up and pictures to show, you know, are you being very biased about an African-American who's more of a liberal arts major instead of a science major, or a woman who's more of a liberal arts major instead of a science
and
major.
And what test is this, the Novak test?
It's called the Implicit Attitude Test.
Implicit Attitude Test.
The IAT.
All right, yeah, I'd like to see that, because we've all got our unknown biases, and I'm not totally sure that bias is such a bad word.
No.
I mean, it can be, obviously. It can be terrible. It's the same with the word discrimination. I mean, discrimination has got an incredibly bad rap because it's been discrimination against, you know, things as opposed to discriminating for. Like if I'm going to taste some, Eddie Castaneda may have a big wine cellar, and I'd like to go down there and test and discriminate and say, yeah, I like this one. Let me take one of these away. But implicit biases that we don't even know we have. That's a tough one.
Right. And the media, advertising, they all
hit those biases, yeah. In fact,
yeah,
right?
They help us shape our biases, you know.
But is NIH itself interested in that as an institute? Not with some of the people who are studying why bias, but Does NIH worry that there's a bias in, say, peer review?
Yes, peer review, hiring. So that's why our team has been helping build this education, and they run it. They go to the different search committees, different departments at NIH, and they do this educational workshop with staff.
Well, so let's just wrap this up by saying, you know, you came down to the University of Texas at El Paso. That's why you're here. And you came here as a representative of the director's office of NIH. What was the goal of this particular two-day visit?
It was to interact with the students and the postdoctoral fellows here and to share about training opportunities at NIH. NIH has an intramural research program with about 1,200 principal investigators. And so research is happening at the main campus in Bethesda, as well as some offsite locations like in North Carolina and Montana.
Okay, so I mean, this was purely to divest possibilities for the students.
Right. Right. So just let them know there's opportunities out there and to apply.
Right.
Encourage them to apply.
But, you know, as a Latina, as a successful scientist Latina yourself, you must bring something else rather than just a list of opportunities.
To try to broaden their network so that they see me as somebody they can approach if they have questions about NIH. So like me being an ambassador for NIH and letting them know that my cell phone, work phone, and email is open to them if they have questions.
And what about some of the aspects that you briefly mentioned about forewarning some of the students about the barriers that they're going to have to overcome, both self-doubt and mentoring or poor mentoring?
I shared with them my pathway and what were my obstacles and how I ended in this career track, and heard their issues and their questions so I can try to see how I can work that into our programming to try to address.
And so in the end, this is quite a fulfilling role that you're playing for the NIH. I mean, you found a niche, you think,
yes,
now, where your experience and expertise in neuroscience, for example, and now you're broadening it to think about how to impact the next generation.
Correct.
You've got the career you want.
Yes. There's these words that Eddie said to me my first year in graduate school, is that, you know, he wasn't there to train me to be like him. He wanted me to excel more than him. I still take that to heart when I mentor students, and with this position, I hope it gives me that, helping the future generations excel better than me.
I tell students the same. Don't be like me, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be a mess. Irene Avila from the Director's Office of National Institutes of Health, it's been a pleasure having you here on Science Studio. Thank you for what you're doing, and good luck with your endeavors in the future.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank Kimberly Garcia for putting this program together, and you, the audience, for listening. Because without you, there's no program. Bye-bye.